We will discuss Olympic athletes and money during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, some advice if you're considering buying a vacation home. And we'll also wonder if today's millennials will ever be millionaires. Also, as always, answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Are you watching the Olympics?
Yeah, I've managed to catch a couple of fencing events, and those are the big ones, right, that everyone's talking about?
Yes, I'm following the fencing, too. How about Michael Phelps and his cupping hickeys?
Yeah, I thought he had been kind of attacked by pod people or something like that, but turns out, no, that's cupping. That's a legitimate alternative medical practice. I think I'm going to try it myself.
Yeah, there we go. The Olympics are worth a lot of money, billions of dollars to just about everyone involved, except, Kevin, you say, one fairly important group of people. And who would that be?
Those would be those athletes. Brazil is spending anywhere from $4 to $6 billion directly, and a total of maybe $19 to $20 billion on infrastructure, try to get Rio ready for this huge influx of people. And in potential revenue, they're probably going to be a money losing venture. These cities do this for prestige, but a lot of people have said that the Greek crisis, the financial crisis they've had, was actually triggered by all the money that they poured into Athens in trying to host the 2004 Summer Games, and they haven't recovered from that yet. So we'll see if Rio actually makes any money off of it. NBC paid about $1.23 billion for the broadcast rights to the Olympics, plus the production costs for it. And in terms of ad revenue, they're actually going to probably break even or maybe make a small profit, according to Ad Age. But there are 11,000 athletes competing in these Olympics, and the best Americans do pretty well as long as they're in the right events: swimming, track, gymnastics, and those would be, you know, your Michael Phelps, Simone Biles, and Katie Ledecky. But the rest, not so much.
Yeah, how much does a typical member of the U.S. Olympic team make by being on the team?
Well, they can make as much as they want from outside activities. You know, the notion of amateurism in Olympics is long gone, and wrestling is the only sport where you're still required to be an amateur. And it really does depend on the sport and status for how much they make. The average Olympian, even for the U.S. athletes, probably makes about $1,000 to $2,000 per month just from the sports governing body, maybe donations that flow through the U.S. Olympic Committee and to them. Doesn't cover very much in the way of living expenses, much less the training expenses and all the travel of competing. And most of these athletes actually have to get a part-time job if they don't have a partner or a spouse who's working and can support them, or a family that has enough money to do it. And they really can't get much of a job because they need flexibility more than they need high pay. They need to be able to get off to train and to compete. So they're generally not going to have jobs that pay very well. And even then, there are the family's expenses just to see these athletes compete at Rio's. I mean, there was a swimmer from the Chicago area who they had probably 15 or 20 people in his box who were watching him compete. And at $3,000 to $4,000 a piece, that's $50,000 or $60,000 that this family had to spend to get all these family members down to Rio.
Ouch. What about if an athlete wins a medal? Don't the medalists earn some big money?
Yeah, from the medals directly, actually not. From the U.S. Olympic Committee, they only pay $25,000 for gold medal winners, $15,000 for silver, and $10,000 for bronze. Now, that pales in comparison to some other countries. Italy purportedly pays $182,000 to their gold medal winners, and Russia pays $135,000. But for the U.S. Gold medal winners, those not only are those sums relatively small, but they're taxed by the IRS as ordinary income, and therefore they only get maybe two-thirds to three-quarters of that in their pocket. But there is some legislation in a rare form of bipartisan sponsorship. Senator Schumer and Thune from the Democratic and Republican side in Congress have co-sponsored a bill that would make this income tax exempt.
What about the future income of the athletes after the games are over?
Yeah, for one or two athletes, especially from the U.S., a few stars rise out and, you know, they do really well. But there were 46 individuals who won gold medals for the United States in 2012. I actually watched those Olympics fairly closely. I can maybe name three or four of them offhand, and especially if you're not going to exclude, if you're going to exclude the Michael Phelpses who have stayed in the limelight and are in these Olympics again. So the prominence in the, and in staying in the public's mind really isn't strong. They obviously get a few endorsements. They might make more money from getting into professional competitions and getting paid appearance fees because they are gold medal winners. Some of them make some money from appearances at different kinds of, you know, car dealerships or events. Others get into speaking, but that limelight really fades quickly. And after a year or two after they've won the medal, unless they can do something else to capitalize on it, they really don't make much outside income for it. Some will get into broadcasting or coaching. You know, they'll open up their own academy for. But there really are very few opportunities for people to get it just from the sports. And matter of fact, the U.S. Track and Field Association did a study in 2012, and they found that half of their top 10 U.S. athletes, now this is in track and field, a very prominent sport, half of the top 10 U.S. athletes in each and every field made less than $15,000 a year. So they spent a lifetime preparing for these few days. Some of them have a backup plan. For instance, you remember Eric Heiden, who won several gold medals in gold medals from speed skating from the Milwaukee area. He became a doctor. And Gwen Jorgensen, who is a Wisconsin Tide athlete competing in the triathlon, she's a favorite actually. She was an accountant at Ernst & Young, so she'll be very skilled in counting whatever money she makes.
Yes. We gotta love that sport. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And with that being said, we have an open line for you. If you have a question, a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, here's a listener from an email from a listener named Glenn's mom and dad. That's an odd name, isn't it? Glenn's mom and dad wrote in to say that their son is going to college this fall, and although they have enough money in an Edvest account to pay for undergraduate school, they want to know if they should continue making contributions. They go on to say that he intends to go on to graduate school as he plans to teach at the college level. So what should Glenn's mom and dad do, Kevin?
Well, several people right now who teach at the college level are wincing at the notion of investing a lot of money trying to help a kid eventually teach at the college level. But good for him and good for Glenn's mom and dad. If all of their other obligations are covered, like saving for retirement, they paid off all their debt, they've got all their other big expenses covered, sure, they can continue to save some money in the Edvest account. It's likely that Glenn will need that money sooner or later, and Glenn's mom and dad will get a small state income tax break on those deposits right now if they are Wisconsin residents. They'll get a tax break on $3,100 of deposits each year, and the deadline for those contributions are April 15th of the following calendar year for the previous tax year. Generally, to get that tax break, you really have to be kind of a close family member to the beneficiary, but you know, cousins, grandchildren, siblings, stepchildren, those all count to get the tax break on the Edvest contribution.
What if Glenn doesn't need the money for college or for grad school?
It actually can be kept in the account, and any earnings will stay tax sheltered until it's pulled out, and it can be passed to another beneficiary. So in this scenario, you might say, well, Glenn didn't need all the money, but he got married or he had a kid or both, and the child needed some money. Glenn's mom and dad can make the beneficiary the grandchildren now and transfer them. It can be used for Glenn's spouse as well. And I like the fact that that Glenn's family probably all refers to themselves as their relation to Glenn. Like Glenn's spouse calls his or herself Glenn's spouse.
Yes.
The kid will call himself Glenn's kid.
And
it's all about
his dog,
Glenn.
Glenn's dog.
I'm Glenn's dog.
What if Glenn or Glenn's mom and dad need to use that money in the Edvest account for something other than college?
The owners can actually withdraw the money whenever they want, and they can spend it however they want. But they will pay no taxes on the contribution portion of the withdrawal, but they will pay taxes and a small penalty, about 10% on the earnings portion. That's usually not so bad. Let's say Glenn's mom and dad had saved $40,000 into this Edvest, and then it had earned $10,000 over that period of time. It's worth $50,000 now. If they were to make a complete withdrawal of that $50,000, they would only pay about $3,000 in taxes and penalties on that whole portion, because only 25% of the withdrawal is actually earnings.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. John in Lake Mills is with us. Hi, John.
Good morning, Joy.
Morning. Go ahead with your question.
Well, mine relates to long-term care. My wife and I purchased long-term care many years ago, in her case 14 years ago, in my case 10 years ago. We just got a notice from our insurance company, John Hancock, that our premiums are going to more than double. And I think what that's going to do is make the current coverage prohibitive at that premium rate, but they have given us a couple of options, and so they relate around to the annual inflationary increase. Currently, we're receiving a 5% increase on the coverage, and the rate would remain, a monthly premiums would remain the same if we retained the 5% annual inflation rate. If we chose to continue with the current monthly premium, we would have to accept a 2.2% inflationary increase. And then they've given the option of in between at 3.2%.
Sure, John. Yeah, that's I understand what's going on. I don't want you to have to read the entire contract to us, but I get what you're going on. It's very alarming, right? Because you were going along and you weren't enjoying paying these premiums. Then all of a sudden, to keep the insurance coverage that you have, they're going to double the premiums. Now, John, do you mind saying how much roughly you pay for a monthly premium?
For my wife and I combined, it's $5,500. Per year. So you have to divide that by 12. So, I'm driving, so I can't do that in my
Okay, head. Good for you. Works out to about $450 per month, or about $225 each, and that's actually pretty normal. Here's what I would do. I would definitely not go with that 5% escalator. I would drop it back down, and you said if you keep it at a 2.2% inflationary rate, then the premiums will stay the same?
John, did you hear that?
Oh, perhaps
he might have.
He try to do the math. Oh dear.
So, no, I hope he's okay. But no, he can't. He
no.
Can't
if that's
respond.
If that is indeed the case, that's a relatively fair rate. It's not a fun thing to pay, but it is something. If they can keep that in place with just a 2.2% indicator, that's a good idea to keep it. You know, one of the things people have to remember about long-term care insurance is that it should be looked upon not as something that you are going to use to cover the entire cost of long-term care. Most people who need long-term care for sure are receiving Social Security. They may have other assets. They may have a pension check. And they may also have home equity built up or a home that's paid for that they can sell to offset the cost. So look upon long-term care insurance, if you do get it, as just something to help pay for those costs, not something that you want to pay for the entire top-of-the-line expense forever. In fact, most people actually don't go to a nursing home for a very long time. I think the median stay right now is about 11 months. And at $6,000 a month or so, that's about $60,000 to $70,000, which is a lot of money. But most people at that stage of life don't need that money for other things. Yes, they may want to leave it for a spouse, or they might want to leave it for family members, but they have to cover their care first before they can look at those goals. So I'd say to keep the policy, it's a pretty good deal, but just let the inflation factor drop down to a more reasonable level.
You're listening to On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. When we come back, we will Take more of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll also have some information and advice on buying a second home for vacations or something else. And we'll also talk about whether millennials can ever become millionaires. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here with information and advice on your money and answers to your, personal finance questions. So what is your financial question today? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones. Leanne in Twin Lakes is with us. Hi, Leanne.
Hi.
Yes, what is your question?
Hi. My question is, I was wondering, my husband and I are co-signing a loan for his younger brother for college, and I was just wondering how that could affect our credit rating or if we needed to take out a loan for any reason.
Yeah, it will actually affect your credit rating somewhat. And because because you co-signed it, if for practical purposes, Leanne, you are taking out this loan. And actually, there is a high percentage of co-signed student loans actually do revert back to the co-signer. So it will affect you to some degree, for better or for worse. You know, if you take the loan out and you make the payments on time, maybe it'll boost your credit rating up. But if there is a problem with it and the payments aren't made on time, yes, it will negatively affect it. Now, are you and your husband, are you planning on borrowing money anytime soon for yourselves?
We might have to get a new vehicle next year.
Okay. And is your credit otherwise pretty good?
Yeah. We're in the high 700.
Okay. That's very good. And for that kind of a, if you're going to be borrowing money to buy a car, and by the way, I do suggest you borrow money to buy a car. The interest rates are relatively low, especially for people who have good credit like you and your husband do. The co-signing of the student loan will not greatly affect it. It might, like I said, a very small amount, but I still think you'll get a very good interest rate on the loan. You'll get the loan and you'll get a very good interest rate on it. Just make sure that, you know, in this kind of situation, you're trying to help your brother-in-law out without actually giving him the money. But if he runs into trouble, make sure that you make the payments to keep the loan current and then straighten it out afterwards, because any missed payments, like I said, will then really start to affect both of your credit ratings.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Nice brother and sister-in-law co-signing.
You noticed who was calling with the question, though?
Yes, I did.
It wasn't the blood relation. I'm married to somebody, and let me tell you, there's a little different perspective sometimes on intra-family loans and helping other out, and it's obviously a lot more difficult for the non-blood family member or the immediate family member to get as excited about helping the family member out. But good for Leanne. Good for her.
It's risky any way you look at it, I suppose. Jackie emails, I have a four-month-old, and my husband and I want to start saving for his future. Is a 529 plan the best way to go? We move from my job every 5 to 7 years, so we're not sure what state he will go to school in.
I went to school for a while in a state of inebriation. That was not recommended, and I hope that Jackie,
that won't happen.
That doesn't happen at all. It doesn't really matter. You can live in Virginia and use Wisconsin's 529 college savings plan to send a kid from Montana to a college in California. The only requirements are that the money pulled out be used for qualified higher education expenses at an accredited institution. And to get government financial aid for its students, the institution has to be accredited. So there's a very high degree of motivation for these schools to be accredited. So just about any kind of higher education institution qualifies as a distribution for it. So don't let that be the barrier to saving for the kids' college.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Time now for smart assets. And low mortgage rates and friendlier lenders are having some homeowners wondering if just one house is enough because two is better than one, Kevin?
No, I own more than one home, and I could definitely say that two is not better than one in most cases. I think they're also motivated by Channel 36 or Channel 42 on your cable dial or dish or whatever it is. That House Hunters channel is the one that gets everybody excited about a second home. And that thing is crack TV, the way it just gets you addicted to it. And you always have to sit through the whole thing and see which one they pull out. It's always Canadians going very, very far south, always wanting to get out of the snow in the winter. That's the standard zone, especially for the House Hunters International one.
But, I have seen those, that couple, by the way. They're all.
Oh, yeah, it's nice. Yeah. It's nice. But the countertops are nice.
You're right. It is crack because I see the, you know, it's a budget oceanfront one or something like that. You know,
mm-hmm. Always wanting the ocean front and arguing about it, like Wiz Lemon said on 30 Rock a long time ago. So, you people, it's paint. You can repaint it. Don't argue about the paint for a $500,000 purchase. Yeah. Anyway, people are considering purchasing a second home for vacation, for retirement down the road, or maybe as a rental, as an investment. This week, we'll talk about purchasing one for a vacation home. This might be a cabin up north. It might be a condo in a warmer climate, or one that's closer to friends and family, or one in a cooler climate if you're a downhill or cross-country skier.
Sign me up. What are some considerations, though, that vacation home buyers should make before doing this?
Not the paint in the kitchen or how much room you have for entertaining. Instead, add up the cost versus the value. And by value, I mean the time you're actually going to spend there. You know, the down payment for these places is going to be at least 20%, depending on the property and your lender. And then you're going to have the mortgage payments as well. Plus, you should plan on spending at least 5% a year of the home's value for taxes, maintenance, insurance, etc. So if you get even a $200,000 place, which depending on where you're looking, that's a fairly modest price. You're going to have to put about $40,000 down. You're going to have an $800 a month mortgage payment, and you're probably going to have about $10,000 per year on average in other costs of property taxes, upkeep. You might have a HOA fees, maintenance, insurance, etc.
Yeah, but then I'd have my place in Hawaii, and but I don't. I'm not sure I can swing that. But for some folks, though, that's maybe not too much to spend for a really nice getaway.
No, it's relatively affordable. Except look at it, the cost versus the time spent there. In the example above, you're going to be spending actually about $20,000 per year on mortgage payments and the insurance, and that doesn't include your $40,000 down payment. And let's say you spend an average of 3 weeks at that place. That's $1,000 per night, plus the work to maintain it, take the dock out, put the dock in, take it back out, put the dock in. I have several people I know who have places up north, and they go up to the cabin twice, once to put the dock in the spring and the other to take the dock out in the fall.
Hardly worth it.
Yeah, probably worth it. Well, then a lot of the families who say, well, you know, we have small kids. We want to go up there a lot while they're young. Well, I'm the parent of teenagers, and the last thing those kids want to do is spend any time with you, especially into some place that's away from their friends, and it's an idealized vision of it, but it really doesn't come to true. And then once you retire, it becomes very difficult to justify saying, well, we're going to spend 6 months out of the year at this one place. We feel obligated to go there because we're spending so much money, but they miss out on traveling to other places as well.
Yeah, I would like to do that, and I misspoke or you misunderstood. It was hardly worth it if you're just going to go up there Day weekend and then, you know, put the dock in and then go up there on Labor Day weekend and take it out. No fun at all.
Absolutely.
Now that you forewarned those of us interested in buying a vacation home, what words of wisdom do you have for those who still are insisting on making this purchase?
Well, if you're not familiar with the area, you know, don't buy off of the website. Start by renting for at least a week or two in the area so that you can not only soak it all in, but you can have some time to leisurely explore it and see which areas you like better, get a better feel for each place, maybe even rent a couple different places over a two-week time on different parts of the island or up in, on the lake, wherever you're looking. And then that gives you a base to shop for the place and find out if you actually really can stand spending more than a few days in this particular particular place. And if you must buy it, put as little down as possible and get a mortgage, especially a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage if it's possible, and have a lawyer review the mortgage documents to see what repercussions you have if you can't afford it or if you just don't want the place anymore. And then finally, look at this place. A lot of people buy these places and say, well, we'll buy it, we'll use it, we'll have fun, and then we'll sell it in a few years and make a lot of money off of it. And that has been possible in the past. It's not as likely to happen in the future. So see what having to sell after a 50% drop would do to your finances and your rest of your financial dreams.
I think I like the idea of checking out a new nice vacation spot each year rather than...
Yeah, that actually sounds a lot more enjoyable than buying a place. Yeah.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question, a personal finance question for him, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, looky here, we have Chris in Anchorage, Alaska with a question. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, thanks for calling. Are you listening online?
No, actually, I'm visiting in La Crosse.
I see.
But
did you just come down so you could hear the show?
Yes.
Yeah, I just swing by to listen to the show.
Good for you. Thank you, Chris.
Yes. Hey, I have a cousin here and her husband, and they mentioned an interest in estate planning. They are married, obviously, no children. And I know just enough about the topic to know that at the time of the second death, they have just their home, no other real property, no children, but they have some personal possessions that they're interested in passing on. And I'm wondering the best way for them to find the right estate planning attorney. And I'd really like your thoughts.
Oh, yeah, it's actually, and I like your thoughts about trying to look out for their interests. And it's not just about what happens to their stuff. What I'm more interested in is what happens to them, and not so much after they're gone, but while they're alive, but are unable to manage their lives or their money or their stuff, because that's a much more likely scenario that's going to create more legal problems than just after they die. The law is very clear about what happens to stuff and people after the people die, but it's not so clear, and it's not so easy to delineate what should happen to people if they are around but not able to function as they've once been able to. So what you want to do is have them check with other financial professionals they might know, like a financial advisor, a banker, maybe a real estate agent, whoever sold the house. But they should also talk to an accountant and see if they can get any referrals. If they just can't find anybody in the area whom they can trust or whom they have confidence in, go to avvo.com, avvo.com, and you can search for lawyers who specialize in a particular area of law in a particular geographic area via that website. And they might want to talk to two or three. It sounds like they don't have a very complex situation, so it's not a huge decision. I'd much rather have them go to someone quickly and get it done rather than use the hemming and hawing over who they should go with as a reason to not do it. So avvo.com, avvo.com. We'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And by the way, when I was on vacation, and you were on vacation, Kevin, in late July, July 26 to be exact, John Munson spoke with an estate planning expert about estate planning and where to turn to for help. You can go to WPR.org and listen to that show if you'd like to for more information. Let's go next to Peter in Argyle. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Do I have to show my extreme enthusiasm this morning? Because I'm really happy to be on the radio.
Yes.
like before. So our Legion Post has some money, and American Legion Post, and so we're trying to figure out a vehicle where the Post can put the money into, you know, something that has better than 0% interest, you know, and has some liquidity, and, you know, if it's guaranteed, that would be great, too. So we've been, you know, knocking around a few ideas, but, you know, we're not experts, and we're looking for some alternatives. I mean, heck, we'd buy coins if it came to that, but, I mean, just looking for, you know, because we're an organization, it's difficult to figure out how we can hold investments.
Yeah, the good news for you, Peter, is that simple and safe is the best for many people, but especially your group's money. And that would be just go to a bank, find the best CD that they'll give you and put it in that. Make sure that there's very little penalty for early withdrawal. But any other kind of investment, there are very few things out there that are safe and liquid, and none of those things pay very much. There are trillions and trillions of dollars and other kinds of currencies around the world all looking for the same thing, and that means they're driving the price up of those kinds of investments, making them, in my opinion, overpriced. And so I'd much rather have you settle for 1 or 2% a year that you can get from a longer-term CD rather than trying to take some risk and then take a chance that you could lose 30 or 40% in a bad year. And if you say, well, we're okay with that risk, then at least split the money so that you've got some that's safe and liquid, and then you've got other money that's maybe not as liquid and not as safe, but might give you a better long-term rate of return. And that would be, stock, mutual funds, et cetera.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks, Peter. Peter showed some enthusiasm, but he needs to really step up the false praise.
He needs to show his enthusiasm for us, for being on the radio.
Really, come on,
anybody,
Peter.
Anybody can do that. Yeah, we prove that each week.
Right, you have to flatter Kevin for being super awesome, or just the show being outstanding and helping you. We are still looking for your comments, your false praise. We use your comments from time to time in promos, as On Your Money has changed, broadcast times on the weekend, and we want to shout about that, now being rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. We are live on Tuesdays, and you can call in on Tuesdays with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, and if you're listening on Saturday, you can email us too. Maybe we'll use your email during a future show. onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. So will millennials ever become millionaires? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley during this edition of On Your Money. Next, talking about millennials and their money. And a new survey says that many young adults don't think they will ever be able to save $1 million. Kevin, tell us more about that research.
It's called the Wells Fargo Millennial Survey. It was conducted by a firm called GFK, and it found that 64% of young adults say they will never get $1 million, and the biggest obstacle they have to that is those who have student loans. 75% of the respondents who had student loans called the loans unmanageable. But still, 6 out of 10 of respondents have begun investing anyway, and the good news is it's actually fairly probable, even likely in some cases, that these young adults will eventually reach $1 million in savings. The bad news, it may not be enough for the wildly comfortable retirement 40 years from now that many of these people might visualize with $1 million in the bank.
Yeah, maybe $1 million isn't going to go as far as you think it's going to. Let's start with the good news, though. $1 million is still a lot of money for a young broke person to contemplate, though, right?
Yeah, if they use their youth and the long period of time they have to save to their advantage, they can still get there. If you want to have $1 million at age 65, and let's say you're getting a 6% hypothetical annualized rate of return, if you start at 55, you need to save over $6,000 per month to get $1 million at age 65. But at 45, you only need to save about $2,200 a month. At 35, you only need to save about $1,000 per month. And at 25, you only need to save about $520 per month to have $1 million by the time you reach age 65, again, assuming a 6% hypothetical annual return. And oh, by the way, parents of teenagers out there, if that kid can save just $280 per month from the time she's 15 to 65, she'll have $1 million if she earns 6% per year. That's only $3,300 per year.
Well, that's an incentive to start a little earlier. What might $1 million in the future be worth in today's money?
Let's assume 3% inflation. That's actually probably a little higher than what current inflation rates are, at least from the government. But if you assume a 3% inflation, 10 years from now, $1 million will buy about $750,000 in today's money, about $560,000 20 years from now. 30 years from now, it'll buy what about $400,000 does. And 40 years from now, it'll still buy about $306,000 worth of goods and services at 3% inflation for what in today's. Now, that it might be disappointing and say, gee, I have $1 million, but it only buys $300,000 worth of today's goods. Well, according to the General Accounting Office, in June of 2015, the median savings for retirement for 55 to 64-year-olds in America is about $100,000. So if you just get to that $1 billion in 40 years, you'd have about three times the amount of money that the average American has saved when they're actually ready to retire.
I'm sure many parents and grandparents are listening and nodding along with this advice right now. What are some ways they can help younger family members get started in savings?
Talk to them. And just tell them and say, look, I know you're young right now. You know, I didn't save early enough. I wish I had. Or I did save and someone got me started. So I'm going to try to help you get started on the right path and demonstrate with online calculators and show them. If you just go to a place like dinkytown.net is actually one of my favorite financial calculator sites. And they have one on there that says that if you just put in, you know, even $50 a week or $500 a month, whatever you can afford to spend, leave it in there, let it grow. Here's how much you'll actually have at those days. If you have an advisor and you have a younger person who you think could use some of that advice, talk to the financial advisor and see if he or she will sit down with the teenager or the young adult and say, look, I just want to answer all your dumb questions because this person cares about you, my client cares about you, and I'd like to be able to help you however I can. And a little bit of information at a very formative age can have a huge effect on this young person's life. If you actually want to put your money where your mouth is and try to help the young person, offer to match their contributions to a 401k, where if you say, well, I'll tell you what, for every dollar you put into a 401k from your own paycheck, I'll give you 25 cents, or I'll give you a whole dollar if you can afford to do that. Or you can actually make contributions to a Roth IRA for anybody, as long as they actually have earned income to justify those contributions to the Roth IRA. So if they have $3,000 of earned income, say from babysitting in a given year, you can make a $3,000 contribution of your money to their Roth IRA, and then they can spend their money however they want.
If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, there is still time for you. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us on your money at WPR.org or post your question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll go back to the phones now, and our next caller is David in Green Bay. Hi, David. What's your question?
I have a question. Currently, I have 15 years at 3% interest rate in home mortgage. I also have some cash saving in my bank account. My question, I plan to use the cash to invest for my retirement. My question is, should I use in current cash to pay back the home mortgage, or what's best to make this decision? Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, what do you think he should do?
Well, the question is, as I understand it, is David has a mortgage that's 15 years. Sure would feel good to pay that off, but he also needs to save for retirement. What should he do with this cash? And I'd much rather have him save for retirement because if he puts all of his money towards paying off the mortgage, the good news is he won't have a mortgage payment. The bad news is he'll have a lot of money tied up into an illiquid asset that he actually needs. He needs to have a roof over his head. And so it's safer for him to have the mortgage and the money than it is to have no mortgage but no money. So if he can slowly bleed that money into a retirement plan, especially if he has an at-work plan like a 401k or a 403b that offers a tax break on the contributions, it's usually smarter to make contributions there than it is to pay off the mortgage because interest rates are very low right now, and especially on a 15-year, you can probably see a rate that's close to 3%. And even in this very tough economic climate, if you look over the very long term, 3% is a reasonable rate of return to think that he's probably going to beat investing on his own, not every year, but over the very long time on average. So I'd much rather have you, David, save for retirement either in an at-work plan or even in just a Roth IRA. Salt that money aside there and then just keep paying the mortgage off as slowly as you can stand.
Thank you, David. Good luck to you. This is going to seem like kind of an odd question, Kevin, but that's because I'm asking it. I have some friends of mine have moved from another state back to Wisconsin, and one is self-employed. The other gave up a job in the other state and does not have a job in Wisconsin yet. They do have enough money, presumably from selling, you know, their home there, that they can buy a home with cash in Wisconsin. And we're kind of talking about your general advice when it comes mm-hmm. to home mortgages. They're not even sure they can get a mortgage because of the employment situation at present, but thought, well, maybe they could get one after they already pay in cash. Can you do that? Can you get a mortgage after you've already paid cash for a house?
You can do it, but if they can't get it beforehand, they're probably not going to be able to get one afterwards. And I would definitely have them approach a lender, say, here's our situation. We have enough money. Is there a way we can still get a mortgage, just to maintain the flexibility in our situation, especially when they're still looking for employment, not sure where they're going to work? That cash can help not only make the mortgage payment, but pay for other living expenses or unexpected emergencies. And even in that situation, if they said, well, we can't get a mortgage, so we're just going to pay cash for a house, I'd almost rather have them rent for a year, maybe until they could figure out what the employment situation and income is going to be, rather than put it all towards a house and then try to figure out getting money back out of the house, especially if they don't have a lot of other liquid assets set aside.
Let's go next to Gary in Wausau. Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Yes, what's your question or false praise?
Okay, what I have is I have a 403 with Nationwide Investment, and it's a guaranteed 3%. It was through my work. How secure is that? Do I have to worry about any risk on that?
Yeah, it's pretty secure. It's not as secure as they would probably lead you to believe, but it's kind of like a fixed interest rate annuity almost, and it's probably called like a stable value account in some way, shape, or form. And it's better than a CD in terms of the liquidity, usually, and it pays more yield, but it's not as safe as a certificate of deposit, and you can't get it anywhere else. Like if you rolled this money out of this 403B into an IRA, let's say, you couldn't buy a similar investment that's as attractive. So I actually like these, even though they're not as safe as the insurance company or the plan provider would want you to believe, and as many people do believe. They're still very good, and they're very competitive, and I like them much better than, say, bond mutual funds, because bond mutual funds don't have as much predictability and stability in terms of their income, and they don't pay nearly as high a yield. The problem comes is when the investments that this guaranteed contract are using go down in value, and especially if people like you decide, oh, I'm concerned about this, I'm going to pull it out and do something else with the money, and the people sponsoring the fixed income account or fixed interest rate account have to then sell securities at a down price. And that can create kind of a run on the bank situation. We had that back in 2008 when the Lehman Brothers crisis happened, and it affected a lot of short-term investments in money markets. And we could have it happen again. But that doesn't mean you should avoid it. It just means you shouldn't put all of your money into it. You should diversify it, and you should keep other monies, Gary, in even safer, more liquid accounts, especially bank accounts with CDs and others that are FDIC insured.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Good luck. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Do you have a question about saving for retirement or investing or saving for college or buying a home? Buying a vacation home? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Sherry in Wauwatosa is with us. Hi, Sherry. What's your question?
Hi there. I'm 68 years old right now and thinking about retiring soon. And I'm also thinking about getting long-term care. But I've also learned about something called the flexible premium universal life insurance policy, something like that, that allows you to pay into it, and then you're able to, and it, you get a dividend from it, and then eventually you can use it in place of, say, long-term care payments, where I don't believe you get dividends on those. So I was just wondering, I wanted to learn more about that option, whether it was a good one.
Okay, just so I'm clear, Sherry, I think this is a good thing to look at. they're not selling you a policy that would actually pay for long-term care. They're suggesting that you first buy a life insurance policy, and then if and when that life insurance policy's investments pay dividends, you then use the dividends to pay for long-term care insurance?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I would stay away from that. And I'd actually stay away from anybody who would make that advice. I'm okay if they had said, look, we have an investment here where you can buy a long-term care insurance rider on a life insurance policy that provides for long-term care if you need it. I'd be okay with that if they said, we just want to sell you a long-term care insurance policy. Or I'd even be okay, but not in most cases, but in some cases where they would actually say, we just want you to buy a flexible premium life insurance. But you're basically doubling the commissions for these salespeople, and I'm assuming they're on commission because most insurance salespeople are. So they're not only getting a commission when you buy the life insurance, but then they're getting a commission when you buy the long-term care with the premiums from the life insurance. And they probably ran an illustration for you that shows like a hypothetical return of 8% or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, that's should be an offense punishable by fine and or jail to be using an 8% prospective rate of return, because if they use something that was more realistic, like say 3%, it wouldn't be nearly as rosy of a picture in the projections. And the fact, it's very unlikely that not only will that policy generate a net of 8% to you going forward, but that even at 3%, that they'll have enough money to pay for the policy, let alone kick off enough cash to pay for the long-term care insurance. So I would definitely shy away from this particular suggestion.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sherry. Let's go next to Bill in Grays Lake. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good morning. Kevin, there's a lot of news about robo-advisors these days. It's not a conflict of interest for you. What do you think about them?
I actually like them because in my practice, it's not a conflict of interest. And I try to be, when I answer questions like this, I try to give my honest answer, what I would want to hear if I were on the other side of the radio. And I actually like robo-advisors. What they are, though, is they're kind of automated investment services where instead of going to a human being and say, here's my money, how would you invest it? You place it in an electronically controlled account. And then the robot, if you will, makes the changes according to what they think will happen or changes in your situation or whatever. But they don't... It's kind of a cookie-cutter approach. It is a way for people with less money than it usually takes to find a financial advisor. Most financial advisors have minimums of at least $250,000 to $500,000, the good ones do anyway. And it's hard to find any good financial advice, but especially if you only have $25,000 or $50,000. Well, the people with $25,000 or $50,000 or less, it's almost more important that those people get good financial advice because they need it to grow and they need it to do a good job. And many of these firms... like Schwab and Vanguard and Fidelity and TD Ameritrade, all these firms have some kind of robo-advisor offering where you can put it with an automated service, and the cost is generally less than if you were to work with an individual because it's scalable. You can usually expect to pay somewhere between 0.25% to 0.5% per year. And I do think people who are just starting out, and maybe more than that, should actually consider them as long as you feel like what you're getting is still worth that relatively smaller fee. Other people say, look, I want a human being to fly my plane. I want a human being to perform my surgery. And I want a human being to help me with my money. And I'm willing to pay more for that. And for those people who can't afford it and can meet the minimum qualifications for financial advice, those people are usually better off going with a good human financial advisor.
Thank you, Bill, for the question, and Kevin for the answer. I hadn't heard of robo-advisors before. Let's though talk about the website of the week now.
Yeah, this is one called Temkin Ratings, TEMKINRATINGS.com. And Temkin is actually a company that measures customer service and satisfaction for lots of different industries. And then they publish and sell the results for people who are interested in it, especially in other businesses. But they do provide a basic service where you can go to TemkinRatings.com and then look and see what customer satisfaction levels are for various companies in various industries. You can sort by banking or life insurance or air travel or automotive or whatever. And it's a great way to get some free knowledge on which company's customers are the happiest. TemkinRatings.com. We'll have that website at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
Excellent. Now, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. Thank you to producers Bill Martins and Kai Brito. Thanks as well to producers Nyasia Ellison and Brianne Chasso. I'm Joy Cardine. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.